live from the Third Coast. It is our time to focus on where genealogy and spirit connect, a time to focus on our connection with ourselves and our past. Here's your host, Susan E. King.
It is actually a gorgeous spring day down here on the Third Coast of Texas. I'm Susan King. Welcome again. We have a really exciting show for you today, and I wanted to kind of set the stage a little bit because, as you know, I speak a lot about how important it is for self-discovery to know who you are, because we all have a family. We all have a history. And sometimes for those who may be adopted or have biological parents that they don't know who they are, may find they have some surprises in their family. And sometimes these truths can be life-changing. About 2 weeks ago, I guess it was a week ago Saturday, actually, I heard the story about our guest, Michael Fosberg, on CNN. And I was really taken with it because he has a story that I think is very compelling, and I really wanted to share this with you because it really is important, not only for all of us, but it's important to understand, too, that sometimes when we find out some truths that can be very, very difficult, that it can change our lives forever. So, Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Susan. It's good to be with you.
It is very exciting. You know, as I mentioned to you, I think when we started communicating over the weekend, I happened to turn on CNN a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Actually, I was trying to get a little bit more information about what was going on in Egypt and happened to hear a little bit about the promo for the segment that they did on you. Right. And it really caught my attention. So, you know, let's start. Your life changed when you were 32 years old. Right. So let's kind of go into the first 32 years of your life, and then we'll talk about all the changes.
Okay. Well, I mean, I grew up in a, I grew up in a working class white family in a blue-collar town just north of Chicago along the lakefront, town called Waukegan. And you know, I was raised by my biological mother and an adoptive father, I guess, so we understand who I'm talking about, a stepfather, so to speak. And when I was, 8 years old, I guess, they started having kids. And so I have a brother and a sister whom I guess technically would be considered a half-brother and sister, although I've never really considered them that way. But we grew up together. They're 8 and 9 years younger than me. And you know, I had a pretty normal childhood. I mean, it was working class in a small blue-collar town north of Chicago. And I wouldn't even consider it a suburb per se, but I guess it was. It was about 40, 45 miles north of Chicago on the lakefront. And my parents both worked, and, you know, we went to school. I went off to school at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis and studied acting and became an actor. I don't know how that happened. Sometimes I still wonder how it happened, but I guess I wonder why it happened, because when I was a child and in my teen years, my early teen years, I was a very scared kid. I was afraid of a lot of things, and it seems kind of odd that then I went on to be an actor, because I can't think of anything more scary than standing on stage and speaking in front of hundreds of people. So a little ironic, I guess. But about when I was, 32 years old, 31 years old, something like that, my parents, my biological mother and, again, my adoptive stepfather, announced that they were getting a divorce. And although I was an adult at the time, actually I was living out in Los Angeles, I was I was failing at trying to make a living in the film and television industry at the time, failing miserably. But they announced they were getting a divorce, and it struck me just like a ton of bricks. I mean, it just really threw me for a loop, and I realized at that time, because of that and via the help of a girlfriend at the time, that I didn't know anything about my biological father. My mother and I had left him when I was 2 years old, I guess, just before I was two. And we went back to live with my mother's parents in Waukegan. And we had been living, I guess, in Boston at the time with my father, my biological father. And we left and went to live with her parents. And then she remarried when I was about four or five, like I said. And so all this time, my mother had never told me anything about him, nor did I ask any questions. Part of that was because, as I said, I mentioned I was a very scared kid. I was afraid of a lot of things. And part of it was because then once I was around 8 or 9 years old, they started having kids, and then we had this family, and, you know, I had this great family. You know, I was growing up in this family, and although I never felt completely connected to them, I always kind of felt like the odd duck or whatever. I still felt like I was in a family, and there wasn't reasons to, you know, really ask questions about my biological father. So here I was, 32 years old. They're getting a divorce, threw me for a loop. I decided, you know what? I think I need to find out who my biological father is. And that's when the journey started to take a sort of strange loop.
There you go. So, you know, during this early time of your life, you knew you had a biological father that was not your stepfather.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, but it really played no role in your life up until that time.
No, I mean, I was at my parents' wedding. I remember being at the wedding. I sort of remember, and when I say my parents' wedding, I'm speaking obviously of my mother and my adoptive stepfather. I sort of remember acting out really poorly. I, you know, cried and act like a brat. And I think my mom and I have actually talked about this. I probably reacted in that manner because here was a man coming into my life who was taking the attention of my mother away from me. And I was acting out.
Right.
So I remember that. I obviously knew that he wasn't my biological father, but I was 4 or 5, and I'm not sure I really had a real solid idea of what it meant to have a father. And slowly but surely, he kind of, I don't know if won me over is a good way to put it, but I mean, we did some things together. We didn't do a lot of stuff together, I will say. We didn't have a lot in common, my adoptive father and I. His interests were not the interests that I was interested in pursuing. I was really a kid who was very interested in sports and music and culture and things like that. And my stepfather was not that interested in sports, was very much a fisherman, and it didn't really resonate with me. I know fishing is popular with lots of young men. It just didn't resonate with me.
Right.
He was really good with tools and all these kinds of things. So we didn't really have a lot of connections. And that's kind of how I grew up.
So all of a sudden at age 31, 32, yeah, you hear about this divorce and you decide that you want to connect with your biological father. Or were you questioning whether you really wanted to do that, or you just felt that compelled that you really needed to?
Well, I think I was really compelled at that point. I think there were the two events that really hit me were, again, the announcement of the divorce, which really hit me like a ton of bricks, and this help from this girlfriend at the time who shared her own personal story, and that was when she was a young girl, about 2 or 3 years old, she lost her father. Her father died in a very tragic accident. He electrocuted himself by accident.
Oh,
and she found him, actually. And so she never got to know who her father was, really, you know, from the age of 3 on. And she proposed to me that perhaps I still had that opportunity, that there, the guy, my father, my biological father, might still be out there somewhere, and maybe he might be pining to learn who I am, too, and I had a chance to go out and find him. So I really felt compelled to do it, yeah.
So let's move forward now. So you decide that you're going to find him. And unlike a lot of people, my understanding is you found him in the first phone call.
Yeah. My mother...
That's pretty amazing.
It is amazing. It's crazy. I my mother had given me three bits of information. One, she told me his name, which was John Sidney Woods. Two, she told me that the last time she had spoken with him was about 30 years prior to this, 25 years prior, something like that, and that he had lived in the Detroit area. And three, which I think just piqued my interest, she said that I looked exactly like him. So I thought, well, gosh, there's a guy that looks exactly like me out there. I want to know who it is. So at the time, this was before we used the Internet for everything.
Right.
And I went to the library because libraries used to house phone book sections from major cities across the country. And I was living in Santa Monica in California at the time. And I went to the library. I looked in the phone book section. I grabbed the Detroit phone book. I looked up his name. I wrote down, I think there were like five or six listings. And then I went home, and I was living in an apartment at the time. It was a rent-controlled apartment. It was about the size of an elevator. It was very small. And I kind of paced the three steps across and two steps back my little hovel afforded me, and I was just nervous. I didn't know what to do. I mean, what am I going to say to this guy? And what if I don't find him? What if this list is no good? I mean, millions of questions racing through my head. So I finally gathered the courage. I called the first name on the list. Guy answers the phone. I said, I'm looking for a John Sidney Woods. And he said, you're speaking with him. And then
wow.
I said, what? And then I thought, wow, wait a minute. You know, there's probably more than one John Sidney Woods, right? So I thought about these. What else can I ask him? And I said, well, did you live in the Boston area in 1957? Because that's where we lived. And he kind of paused and he said, yes, I did. And then I thought, wait a minute, I need one more confirmation. And I said, were you married to an Armenian woman by the name of Adrienne Pilibosyan? That was my mother's maiden name. And he paused what seemed like for an hour. and he said, yes, I was. And I realized I had tracked my father down on the first phone call.
And what were your feelings at that point? Do you remember?
Well, I was just... I was so elated. I couldn't believe it. And I was so nervous, too, because suddenly... There were two things. One, being so thrilled that, oh my gosh, first phone call, this is my dad, first time I'm talking to him. And then two, I remember thinking that I had heard stories on, I don't know, if on television or news programs or whatever, about kids who had gone out and found their parents, and then the parent didn't want anything to do with them. You know, they had left that woman years and years ago, and they buried that secret or whatever, and suddenly this kid shows up on their doorstep and they don't want anything to do with it. So I kind of blurted out, it's okay if you don't want to talk to me. I just called to find out how are you doing and let you know I was doing all right. And he quickly said, no, my godson, how are you? Where are you?
Wow.
Yeah, and I think it took my breath away.
I just got goosebumps, so.
Yeah. Yeah, and I said, I told him where I was living, and, you know, I told him a little bit about myself, and he shared a little bit about himself, and we're talking, and then he said, you know, son, there's a couple of things you should know. I'm sure your mother's never told you. And I thought, okay, well, like what? And he said, well, first of all, I want you to know that no matter what you were told, or what you thought happened, I have always loved you and thought of you a lot.
Oh, wow.
And I mean, my heart just cracked open. I mean, it was just, here was my father telling me for the first time that he loved me and that he'd been thinking about me all these years. And then he said, there's one other thing I'm sure your mother's never told you. And I said, what? and he said, "I'm African American."
Wow.
And, yeah, I remember. I'm in an apartment that is about the size of an elevator. It is tiny, and I was standing next to my dresser, and my body just sank, and I kind of braced myself against my dresser, and to hold myself up, and I'm holding the phone with my other hand, and there's a mirror across the room, and I sort of glanced in the mirror as if perhaps I had changed in that instant from white to black. Or something, I don't know what. And then he said, "You know, your grandparents are still alive. They live in Virginia Beach, Virginia." And he heard I wasn't speaking, and he said, "Are you okay?" And I sort of stumbled. I said, yeah, I'm great, I'm good." And I said, "You're right. She never bothered to mention that." So.
Now, is your mother was still alive at this particular point in time?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. So yeah. You had to deal with your mother along with your newfound father about this whole subject too, I presume.
Well, right. So then after I got all this information, my father told me more bits of information about my family, about members of my black family who'd have played a significant role in the African-American community in this country. I have a great-great-grandfather who was a member of the 54th Regiment in the Colored Infantry Unit in the Civil War. My great-grandfather on my grandmother's side, my grandmother's father, was an all-star pitcher in the Negro Leagues. My grandfather, Roy A. Woods, was a genius, and the science building at Norfolk State University is named after him. And, you know, I'm absorbing all this information. I'm like, wait, whoa, can we go back to the black part first? Hold on. And I'm absorbing all of this. And I'm just trying to understand it all and put it into perspective and what this all means and how to digest all of this.
Well, I mean, it obviously was a shock because you had absolutely no idea leading up to this particular phone call that you were going to find out something that, you know, is a shock to one system, even though probably at the end of the day, as we'll probably discuss moving forward, that we're going to find it really doesn't matter as much as we portend it to be.
Right. I mean, this is all about the whole issue of how we identify ourselves. And for that matter, how we identify other people, how we look at other people, and suddenly in that one instant, in that one moment, I suddenly, you know, it was like my whole identity was completely rocked, you know, turned on end, and then back again. So, it brings up a lot of different issues.
So I take it you've had the opportunity to meet your father.
Yes. I went with my girlfriend at the time. We went out to Virginia Beach. He was living in Detroit. He flew to Virginia Beach, and we went to meet my grandparents and my father, and we had this reunion, and it was, I mean, I'll never forget the, you know, we went there the day before he did, and my grandparents greeted us and met us, picked us up at the airport, and that was just, I mean, you know, beyond belief. My grandmother is just the embodiment of love. It was unbelievable. And then they took us back to their house, and, you know, my grandmother kept everything. So the house is like a museum. I mean, there are things, items that she kept from her parents, from her grandparents, from her great-grandparents. She had documents, you know, lining the walls. My great-great-grandfather's induction papers into the 54th Regiment are hanging on the wall. The Negro League's contract is there. It's all this stuff, you know, just photos, everything. And then the next day, we woke up, my grandfather went out to pick up my father at the airport, and I remember him coming into the room, coming home, coming into the room, and it was as if I had looked in a mirror. I mean, I look exactly like him. It was,
wow.
I guess I was going to say I'd never seen anything like it, but I guess I see it every day when I look in the mirror. So, but, you know,
that
I mean,
was
one truth
your mother didn't lie about, right?
Yeah. Well, and here's the other thing, you know, I mean, think about this. And my mother admitted this to me much later in the story, but she told me that there wasn't a day that went by during my childhood, during my teen years, that she looked at me and she didn't see my father. And I thought, Mom, I said, how painful must that have been for you to not have been able, or whatever, not have been able to tell me who my father was. I mean, she kept that secret, and yet every time she looked at me, she saw the secret.
Now, so, did she keep the secret from your stepfather as well?
Well, it depends on who you ask. Yeah.
Okay.
She claims that she told him. He claims that he was never told.
Okay.
So, and like you said earlier, too, So imagine having the conversation with your father that you found, having to tell your father that you found your father. I'm speaking of having to go to my adoptive father and have a conversation with him that I found my father. Imagine how awkward and uncomfortable that conversation was. And then I had to share with him my biological father's race and history and whatnot. And my stepfather was shocked. And then he caught himself. And he realized, just like you said, that it didn't matter, that he loved me for who I was, and I was his son. And, you know, it's been a very difficult road for us, but I'm very happy to say today that my stepfather and I are closer than we've ever been.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, you know, here you are, age 31, struggling actor out in California.
Yep.
And... you know, you're doing some phenomenal things today that probably you would have never done had this truth not been presented to you. It pretty much changed your life, didn't it?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it changed my life in the fact that one, obviously, my life is much richer and much fuller today. I have a complete picture of who I am and what my family is, my you know, no pun intended, Arthur Haley, but my roots, so to speak. You know, the finding out that I'm half African American was not for me perhaps a terrible thing or a thing that I struggled with, because actually during my whole life, my teenage years and college years, I had always felt a deep connection to African American people, African American culture, but I could never explain why. I mean, I had no reason to believe that I was black. I was being raised in a white working class family. I couldn't have been anything other than who they were, really, you know? I mean, I know I didn't know my biological father, but it never occurred to me that he could be anything other than white, which, you know, that's an interesting thought there. And then the other thing that's changed for me significantly is, obviously, I go around the country now. This is what I do for a living. I go around the country and I tour the play. I do over 80 shows a year to high schools and colleges and performing arts centers and theaters, and lately I've been doing shows for corporations and for military bases in the guise of diversity training. And I share the story, and then I engage dialogue, the audience, in very profound, provocative dialogue afterwards about who we are, how we identify each other, what kind of stereotypes do we use, and all of these different things. And then, of course, I just released the book, the memoir, which I've just published, Incognito, An American Odyssey of Race and Self-Discovery. And so that helps as another tool to help get the message out.
Well, while we continue to talk, I'm going to open up the phone lines and see if we can engage some of our audience in some dialogue, because I think it's very important what you're doing. I think, you know, the whole concept of knowing who we are, and, you know, race, and in my belief, I mean, I was brought up in a Jewish home, so, you know, there are all kinds of issues there. And I deal with clients all the time who claim that they identify with Jewish people and want to see if they can find, you know, a Jewish person in their family lineage. So,
sure.
You know, we all tend to identify. You know, I told you before we went on the air, I play steel drums. I mean, I don't know where that comes from. You know, I have actually done my genealogy, and there's nothing there, you know, unless there is some deep, dark secret that we may find. But I've had a couple of friends look at me and say, you know, there's something there. I too have had an affinity for African American people. I addressed it because we had live-in help when I was young, and some of the people that we had, I became very close to. They were like my sister. I mean, it was something that they were very, very important parts of my life. So. Mm-hmm. I can certainly appreciate that. But the number is 888-815-9756. I'm sorry. I had the paper up a little too high, and my reading glasses weren't quite getting there. But I think it's important because the whole concept of race in today's world, you know, there are so many people that go out and get DNA tests done. I don't know if you've done that
I have not, actually. No,
you know, that there are African Americans who find out that their DNA tests don't show as much African American ancestry as one would think, and vice versa. And there's a lot more of this than we think. And I remember when I first started out in genealogy, there was a Jewish man, I think his name was Weiss, and he lived in Texas, and I think he started Esso Oil Company, and that some of his descendants were half and half. And so there's a lot more of this in America, I think, than we know of.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and I think that, you know, it should not be a frightening thing. You know, it should be, you know, to me, knowing yourself and knowing the truths is more important than hiding behind things that, you know, are really not that important. It's, you know, I think that that's really where people are wanting to go today, is that they want to find out who they are and what their truth is and what their purpose in life is. And, you know, from what you're doing today, Michael, with Incognito, you basically have taken a truth and turned it into a life purpose.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Joseph Campbell. I don't know if you've read much Joseph Campbell, but he was one of the nation's big writers about myth and mythology and religions, and he did that whole series with Bill Moyers on Power of Myth and whatnot. And he used to write about a lot about following your bliss, finding your bliss, and following your bliss, and finding your life's purpose, and about finding yourself. And he talked about it's a mythical journey in a way, because you really, in order to go out and find yourself, it's like going out and slaying the dragon, and you have to go out and do it somehow. You can put it off, you can try to avoid it, but ultimately at some point in your life, whether you're 18 or 81, you're going to have to go out and slay that dragon somehow. And I truly believe that. You know, I mean, again, it didn't happen for me until I was 32 years old, but I talk to people all the time, though, who, you know, come up to me after the show and share their stories with me, and some are on that journey right now, some have done it, some are afraid to do it, you know, but you got to do it.
You really do. What was your girlfriend's reaction when all this came down?
Well, she was great. Yeah, she was great. She, she absolutely embraced it, embraced my family. It was hilarious. She just absolutely loved it. And we're not together any longer. We split up many, many years ago, but we've remained really close friends. And one of the reasons I think we have remained close friends is because that journey that we took to meet my father and my grandparents was one of the most remarkable journeys of our lives, and we will forever be connected by that. So I'm honored that I can still, you know, call her a friend, and we talk on a regular basis. She's out in Los Angeles, and I'm obviously based in Chicago, but we talk pretty regularly, and I send her a copy of the book, and she said, I actually called her the other day and said, so have you read the book yet? She goes, I've only read the parts that I'm in. I said, what? Well, there's a whole other section you could read. But she hasn't done that yet. So,
so the book is available at, I take it, Amazon or?
Yeah, you can get it at Amazon, and you can get it at our website, which is incognitotheplay.com.
Okay.
So, both of those places right now.
And I'm a little bit concerned. I'm not sure I have the right chat up to see if we have any calls coming in. So if I can get our producer to kind of write to me, make sure that I'm seeing the right thing. I don't want to miss anything. I don't know how that happened, but I'm not sure I have it. So, again, the number is 888-815-9756. So when you go out and you do the show, and I put a little blurb on my website that, you know, the whole concept of this one-act play that you're doing is really to walk through some of, I guess, not only the story as you've told it, but the feelings and the sharing of some of the feelings that everybody had, including you, as you progressed through this whole process.
Right. The play is about an hour long, and over the course of the hour, I portray about 12 different characters from my life, of people that I met along the way, and I tell the story as if it is happening in the moment, as if it is happening right then and there, so that I'm going on this journey to discover my father, and the audience is going along on that journey with me. So the emotions are all very fresh and very raw, and like you say, but a lot of people, I mean, I don't imagine there are a lot of people that have had the same experiences I have. In other words, they haven't necessarily discovered that they're black, but they have experienced the same kind of emotions, the same kind of feelings, the same kinds of thoughts about who we are, who I am, all of these things. And so they go along the journey, and sort of the journey becomes their journey.
You know, it is interesting. I have a brother who was adopted, and my mother was actually adopted. So, you know, we've, you know, been going through some of these same things. I know that you know, my mother was a little scared. In fact, during her lifetime, we did not pursue it because she was scared and she didn't want to know. And I've talked to a lot of adoptees too over the course of my career, and a lot of them are hesitant about whether or not they really want to know. And I tend to believe it's very important. Whether you connect or don't connect with the individuals, and in a lot of cases you were lucky in that your father was still alive. A lot of people will, you know, connect and find out that they are deceased, and you know, that would be a whole nother story and subject and, you know, emotion that one would have to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so yeah, go ahead.
Well, the play itself has a very uplifting and inspiring message, obviously. I went out on a search to find my biological father and subsequently discovered myself. And I guess in essence that's really what the book is about. But the book has perhaps not maybe as I don't want to put this. I don't want to say it has a Disney ending. The Disney part of the ending is that I am very comfortable now because I have a greater understanding about who I am and what I am. And sometimes I don't have all the answers. I pose a lot of questions in the book, and I don't have a lot of answers for those questions. And what I've discovered over time is that it's okay not to have the answers to all the questions. It's okay. And I feel good about that, actually, which is great. But one of the things that it does expose, the book exposes more than the play doesn't, is that even though I went on this journey, I found this wonderful family and whatnot, the relationship with my biological father has really helped me see that I was very fortunate that I wasn't raised by him.
Uh-huh.
He's a very, I don't want to say very, he's sort of a troubled man, and he's had kind of a difficult life, although he's lived a more of a privileged life for a black man, I would say more of a middle class privileged life per se, but he struggles with the whole idea of who he is and what he is. I think that's actually one of his biggest problems, is that he never really understood or accepted who he was and what he was. And I talk a lot about this in the book, and also a lot about the whole idea of father and son relationships, and what are they, and what do they mean, and what should they look like, and all of these different issues. And what I discovered through, again, this journey was that even though I don't have a lot in common with my stepfather, he raised me with just the utmost integrity and ethics and morals and values, and I am extremely grateful for that. And I think I write about that quite a bit in the book, about how that all came out. And so I guess the reason I'm saying all this is, you mentioned that a lot of adopted people are scared to find out these things. And I agree, there's a lot of scary stuff to find out. But you know what? You know what you're going to find out even more? Just by taking the journey, you're going to find out so much more about yourself. In other words, the journey itself is going to teach you a lot about yourself, who you are, what kind of person you are. And you may discover that that person or that family that you find is not necessarily, you know, the Disney family you thought you would find.
Right.
And that's okay. The journey is going to teach you a lot about yourself, too.
Right.
So I'm really grateful that I took the journey.
And let's talk about your mom.
Sure.
Once, obviously, you told her that you had called him.
Yeah.
And what was her reaction to it?
Well, before I called her to tell her this, I realized that, you know, she had lied to me, basically. I mean, I don't know if lying is the correct word, betrayed. I don't know. She didn't tell me information that I felt she should have told me, that
right.
concerned my identity, withheld, whatever you want to call it. And I was very, very angry about this. And I was so angry that I didn't know how to call her. I didn't know how to confront her. I was extremely angry. And I had been angry with her because of the divorce that she had between her and my stepfather. I kind of blamed her for that. So now, finding out this information, I was so angry with her. I didn't know what to do. And this is just another miracle of, you know, things happen for a reason kind of thing. We're not always sure why. But a friend of mine who I hadn't spoken to in a couple years called me up out of the blue, asked me, you know, what was going on. I told him the whole story. He actually, one of the things he said to me was, I always knew you were black. And I was like, what?
know,
I got that reaction from a lot of people. But then I told him I was really angry with my mother, and he said to me, a beautiful thing. He said, you know, you have an opportunity here to absolve your mother of the shame that she has held your entire life. I mean, she got this shame from her parents, Armenian immigrants, and she's held on to it your entire life, and you now have an opportunity to help her let it go. And I just, in that moment, I realized how difficult it must have been for her to have come from an immigrant family. This is back in the late 50s. And I don't want to downplay her family, her parents' racism or prejudice, but they were not unlike other immigrant families that came to this country, whether you were Greek or Italian or Irish or Jewish or whatever. They want you to marry one of your own. And the fact that my mother was with a black man and had a child was completely unacceptable, and she had the shame that she had to carry my whole life, and now I had an opportunity to help forgive her, to help her release it, and it was like the most beautiful thing I'd ever heard.
It was liberating for her.
Yeah, it really was.
Oprah made that comment, that I don't know if you caught her show a couple of weeks ago, when she found out that she had a half-sister that she didn't know she had.
Yeah, I heard about that. But yeah.
And how liberating it was for her to confront her mother and to really liberate her mother. And she talked about how liberating it was that her other sister, who had leaked out the fact that she had had a child when she was 14, Oprah had had a child, that at the end of the day, how liberating that was for her, to allow the truth to come out.
Yeah. I've heard this phrase. I don't know who to attribute it to. But the phrase is, forgiveness is the hardest work that you'll ever do, but the most rewarding.
Exactly.
And I believe that to be true.
And it is so important to be able to forgive. And the whole concept of learning about ourselves through, and this is why I do genealogy, and this is why I get very excited about these kinds of things, is because it is so important to understand why some of our ancestors, and these are our direct ancestors, whether they're our parents, our grandparents, or whatever, don't sometimes tell the truth, and to understand that and forgive them that is really what makes you the person that you are. And I've told the story on this radio show many times. My poor grandmother grew up thinking her father committed suicide, when in fact he had remarried and died of natural causes. And my grandmother lived to be 85 years old, and to her deathbed, she thought her father had abandoned her and committed suicide. And how important it is for the truth to be told.
Everybody's got family secrets. Sure. Everybody does. Why is it so hard for us to forgive these kinds of things, and yet we forgive politicians or athletes or celebrities for their discretions like they never happened? Why is it so easy for us? Is it because it's personal? I mean, who's still talking about Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky? who's still talking about whatever? We forgive. I mean, Michael Vick this year, the big story in the NFL. I don't know how much you know about sports, but the guy was in prison for dogfighting, and now he's back playing, and he's playing at a level that's unprecedented, and everybody's like, forgive, forget, Okay, he's not my relative. But why should we forgive that guy? But you're not going to forgive your grandmother or your mother or whatever. What? Why would you do that? I mean, it seems to me that we've kind of got it backwards. We should be forgiving our family members and not forgiving the rest of these schleps.
And it is true. And sometimes the only way we can forgive is to be able to learn the truth. Yeah. And, while the truth might have hurt initially, look at how far and really how progressed your career has taken you over these many years.
Yeah.
And had you not gone through this experience, you would not have, you know, had the opportunity to do what you're doing. You wouldn't have had a script to put together for Incognito.
Right. Right.
So, you know, sometimes these truths really are so important. And my producer is not responding to me, so I don't know if I'm in the right area, and I apologize. But if there are any callers, I may not be in the right area to know. So hopefully he will respond to me and keep me posted, and otherwise we will just keep on going.
Okay. No problem, no problem.
Well, I apologize because for some reason I may not be in the right place. It doesn't happen very well. I tell you what, normally we have we use Skype, and I can tell when I'm in a conversation with two people, and I don't see that. So, in any event, that's the little technical sides of doing.
Well, we've got plenty to talk about. I'm not worried.
Oh, don't we ever? So, you did confront your mom, and you were able to do it in a forgiving way.
Yeah.
And so,
for her, it was like the weight of the world had been lifted off her shoulders. I mean, she was so relieved and just. It just pushed our. I mean, my mom and I have always been very close, so this just pushed our relationship to a whole nother plateau. And I know she kind of laughs now because she's seen the play and she's read the book, and it's difficult for her. I say this often after shows. Imagine if someone had written a tell-all about your family. I mean, it might be a little, you know, you might feel a little awkward about, you know, having that all, you know, made public. And so I understand my family is a little skittish when it comes to this, but she has from time to time felt a little, I don't know, ashamed about the choices that she made. But I have to tell you, so many people have come up to me after the show or after reading the book and have said, you know, oh my gosh, your mom was just an amazing human being to have gone what she went through and to, you know, have come out of this and raised you and all of these things. And, you know, I tell my mom that, and she definitely makes her feel better about it and about what she went through, what we did and everything. And again, our relationship is really, you know, really close today, so.
So it was strengthened too.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny that even like the other members of my family, like my stepfather, and I have a brother and sister, as I mentioned, who initially were very, very not in support of me doing this. As a matter of fact, I can remember my brother asking me to sort of cease and desist at one point in time. But and again, from the same standpoint that I just mentioned, imagine someone telling your life, your family story, and would you feel comfortable having that made public? So they were very cautious about that and about how it was going to affect their parents, and they didn't really understand why I needed to go out and search for my biological father. They were like, well, what's wrong with you? You got a mom and dad. Why do you need to do this? And they didn't understand that, you know, as an adopted person, you might have something that, you know, doesn't feel complete to you. And they both subsequently have read the book, and they both remarked to me how much more they understand about me that they never understood or never bothered to ask. And it's really opened up doors for us. And all of my family now has been very, very supportive of it and supportive of the work that I do. And we now have had conversations about race that we never had when I was growing up. And this is something that is kind of common in white families. I mean, dialogue about race is very little, if any. It's really kind of non-existent because it's not usually a part of your life as you grow up. And yet, people of color, that dialogue is kind of a daily part of their lives. So this being interjected into my family was sort of they were very nervous about it, but it's been a really eye-opening thing for all of us, and really great.
Now, you, so, you know, your taglines and for your promos, you know, have pictures of you black, you know, question mark, white, question mark.
Yeah.
Did you feel at any point that you had really changed in that quote unquote race picture, or do you really still, you know, I am who I am, and the race is not, you know, as important, other than it's part of me historically?
Well, I mean, this is the whole issue of, I think we do a terrible disservice to people in this country. I mean, maybe it happens in the world too. I don't. Yeah, it probably does. You know, we give people two choices. You're either black or you're white. You're either a Democrat or a Republican. You're either a conservative or a liberal. You're either pro-life or, you know, pro-abortion. I mean, but the problem is that there's so many different variables in between these two choices. It's not cut and dried. Nothing is. And yet, we continually force people to choose one of those two boxes. I mean, even though, like, the recent census gave people a lot more boxes, the problem with the recent census was it was very confusing, for one thing. They had a question that related to origins, and I'm speaking of Hispanic or Spanish origins, and then
right.
The next question related to race, and it had all these boxes. And so for me, it's like, well, what's the difference between Spanish origins and these race boxes? I mean, why are these races and that's an origin? I mean, that doesn't make sense. And then the boxes that we used for race this year, the first box was white, which I have two problems with that. One, why is it first? We always put things in alphabetical order, so it seems a little odd that it's first, but that's another issue.
And then
secondly, what does white say about who we are as light-skinned people? I mean, you're Jewish. Do you feel white or do you feel Jewish? I mean, how do you identify? You know, I mean, it's. I don't think it helps us really understand who we are. And so, again, they had a lot of other boxes there to check for people, and you can check more than one. That was the big thing this year. You could check more than one. But for me, even though I guess half of me is what is considered white, I couldn't check the white box because it didn't really say who I was. I checked the black African-American Negro box, which, okay, when did we use Negro last, in the 50s? But the white box I couldn't check, and so I checked other, and I wrote in Armenian, because my childhood growing up, I felt Armenian. That was what my mom's family was, and that's the kind of food I ate when I was a kid, and that's the kind of culture I was brought up around. And so, again, the whole idea of how we identify is we continually try to cram people into one choice or the other, you know, whether it's race or political, you know, affiliation or other things, you know. And I think it's a disservice to all of us. I think we can talk more than just sound bites.
You know, I tend to really agree, and I think that you know, I think I have a poem on my website that, you know, no matter who we are ethnically or race or whatever, is that we're all here to take a journey step
right.
by step. And
right.
we are all born. We all take the journey and we all die. And there isn't a person on this earth that doesn't follow those three patterns in our lives.
Right.
And they can be, you know, live on the other side of this world, and it doesn't matter. You know, that we all take the same walk through this lifetime. And I think that that's so important. And I also think, and I think that your story, too, is so important because, you know, we are who we are, and we are who we are because of both how we were raised and who where we came from historically. And there are all these things. I mean, we talk about DNA, and we talk about our how we were raised culturally. But, you know, really who we are is, and you brought this up, and I think it is so, so very important. We are who we are because of the journey that we make.
Mm-hmm.
And the journey can be made. And I think that the compelling virtue of your story is the fact that you are who you are, even though the facts of who you thought you were didn't turn out to be what you spent the first half of your life thinking.
Right.
And a lot of this, and I don't know if you've had a chance to watch any of the Who Do You Think You Are series on NBC, which is,
I have not.
You know, where they take the genealogies of stars, and I think Rosie O'Donnell is this coming week, this Friday.
Is this the thing that was hosted by Henry Louis Gates, or no?
No, this is another one. This is Lisa Kudrow's show.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, the stories are, you know, very interesting how they, I think Vanessa Williams also found one of her ancestors in the first colored infantry in the Civil War.
Mm.
You might want to contact her. I think that would be wonderful.
Mm.
But in any event, the whole series is based on, you know, the journeys that a lot of people, you know, of these stars, because people can relate to them. And it's really bringing genealogy into mainstream as far as I can see it. And I mean, I have to laugh too that we're also starting to see a little genealogy come out to play in one of my favorite little shows called Brothers and Sisters. And they just brought that in about 2 weeks ago.
Huh.
About some family stories that are starting to surface. And, you know, it's very interesting how this whole process of genealogy and learning about who we are, you know, is really so important. And I think that what you've done is incredible. I think that, you know, really how you've taken your story and, you know, and taken it out to the public and, you know, giving them the insight that they need to, you know, that everybody needs to realize that, you know, race should not be an issue in who we are.
Mm-hmm.
Our religious preferences should not either, really.
I agree, but I think that one of the things that if we talk about genealogy, we talk about all these uniquenesses that we have, you know, from wherever, different parts of the world and different historical backgrounds and whatnot, and those are really rich and wonderful stories and events and all of these things. But I think what we tend to do as people is we tend to look at people and immediately we look for the differences right off the top. We look for the differences. What if we turn this whole thing on end and instead of look for the differences, look for the similarities first?
Good point.
I mean, like you said, you know, we're all human. We're born, we have a journey, and then we die. Okay, they're similar. We all bleed red. We all, there are lots of similarities that we have, but instead of looking for the similarities, the first thing we do is look for the differences. What if we looked at the similarities first and then looked at the differences after that? Because I think we would find a much more richness in the differences after we looked at the similarities first.
You know, that is outstanding. And that is a wonderful way to close the hour, Michael. I really appreciate you joining me.
Sure.
And it has been really a very insightful hour. And I think that your website is www.incognitotheplay.com, correct?
Correct. Right. That's right.
And we had a good audience, Michael. I think everybody just wanted to listen.
Well, thank you, Susan, so much. It was really a pleasure to talk with you.
Same here. Thanks again.
All right.
This is Susan King. I will be back next Tuesday. Angela will be with me. And Deborah Silverman, who was supposed to be on the show today, is going to be on the 1st of March. So mark your calendars. Everybody have a wonderful week. We will see you next Tuesday.